Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com. This is a fun one, right? I always like talking about history and the things that we learn. We went through this a little bit, and stand by, Melinda. We'll get right to you. I want to pass this along. It was May 13th. We had Eugene Little Coyote here as an assistant to the vice president of the Tribal Council for the Northern Cheyenne, Ernest Littlemouth. I think my takeaway here is that if you listen, you can learn a ton about our history. And then think about that. You know, does it affect you today? What kind of perspectives are new? Melinda McFarland joins us. She is with the National Park Service, Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument, and the Interpretation and Visitor Services Program Manager. Melinda, good morning. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm great. I'm happy to be on the show this morning.
I appreciate you being here as well. This is such a big week, and we've kind of been talking about it a little bit, so why don't you lay it on us? I mean, are we really expecting as many as 10,000 there? And I think I know the tribe are going to bring some numbers themselves, aren't they?
Yeah, we definitely expect this to be a very busy weekend for the monument. Upwards of 10,000 people per day, especially on June 25th, as that is the day that the battle occurred. So we expect our highest visitation that day. Just talking to visitors, tribal members in my regular every day. I mean, I've talked to people from Ireland this week. I've talked to people from all across the United States, getting phone calls, emails. So it seems like everyone's pretty excited and really invested in this anniversary.
Why? Why is it so interesting or even fascinating to us and the outsiders?
I think one of the reasons, or a couple of reasons, is one, to the tribes, it's a very significant sort of victory day, as this momentous occasion where they stood up for their protecting their traditional ways of life and how that sort of resiliency has carried on sort of through the generations. And I think for the general public, of all the events kind of in American history, this one has taken on its own mythology, its own kind of popular cultural media. We still see it come up in television shows today. It just kind of has that cultural presence and that sort of mysticism and mystery of what happened with Custer and his last stand that the general public just kind of attaches to.
We got, you have, and we as the American public have a lot of events, as you noted, June 25th, especially the Parade of Nations, the 7th Cavalry Color Guard, Air National Guard Fly, a lot of stuff, and point people to the National Park Service to get more information. It's nps.gov, and then look up Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument. And I want to talk about that, but the first thing off my list here is really how interpretations of this battle have changed over the 150 years. And you know, we had a really good conversation with members of the Northern Cheyenne tribe, you know, from their perspective, and they've been trying to make sure their perspective is entered into the mythology, as you noted, of all of this. Maybe talk about that. I'm curious as to this, how we have years ago moved from Custer's last stand to something much more inclusive that is really true to history.
Yeah, so one of the main things with like interpretation, especially around the site, is it's really influenced by what's happening at the nation of the time. So we can almost trace the interpretation of the Battle of Little Bighorn or Greasy Grass to what the general public or that public history is at the time. So right after the battle happened, we can see, you know, June 25th, 26, 1876, this is on the eve of the centennial of the United States. So this loss kind of reverberated throughout the nation, and it was kind of seen as a stop to the progress of the United States. So from that point on, it really became an interpretation of the military loss, this like sort of stop to that progress. And that interpretation continued for a long time. It was really about that 7th Cavalry story. And even when folks learn about it in history, it's kind of up into Western history sort of stops at 1876. And we don't go really further beyond that point. But then so things start to shift kind of mid-1900s, really in the 1970s, when things like the American Indian Movement really gain momentum, or Dee Brown's book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, gets published, we start to see even the interpretation of the site change in popular culture with films like Little Big Man, and the U.S.'s entry into the Vietnam War sort of shifts public understanding about Western history and the role of the United States government with tribal nations. And because that starts to shift in sort of the popular culture or the public's understanding, we can see that shift with the interpretation at the site. So things start to be a little bit more inclusive in the 70s and the 80s. And then in the 90s, with the name change that happened, kind of spurred by Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell shifting that name change from Custer Battlefield National Monument to Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument, and the inclusion of funding for the Indian Memorial, we start to see that progress even further. And I'm really excited to be involved with the interpretation at the site right now, because we are building a new visitor center, which means new exhibits. And we've been able to work more closely with tribal nations like the Northern Cheyenne, who've been incredibly instrumental in their input of trying to highlight more of that story, not just that two-day battle, but what led up to it? What were the U.S. policies with the tribal nations, and what was the aftermath of that? Because that effect is, I'm sure they talked about, didn't just stop at the Battle of Little Bighorn, but still sort of reverberates through the Western landscape today, especially with those tribal communities.
Yeah, it does. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Oh, no, I was just going to say, so we're hoping, you know, past the 150th that we can take this momentum and continue to have an inclusive sort of narrative, a multiple perspective interpretation at the site.
How much appreciation is there for that in and of itself?
I think from a tribal perspective, like the Northern Cheyenne said, and, you know, the Lakota, Dakota, Nakota nations as well, is that this is a very important moment in their history, and it's important that they feel welcome at the site, that they have that perspective shared to the general public. And even when I talk about talk with the general public, you know, the everyday visitor that comes in here, they're very aware of that history as well. And I've been asked, you know, why we aren't having more of that interpretation. So I think there is a desire for that from the public as well, you know, presenting history as it happened and not kind of shying away from some of those stories.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. I mean, sometimes our lessons are real hard learned, and I know this is the case. And if you haven't read much about our relationships with the Native Americans, the U.S. government, and even the U.S. people, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee is a really good book to get that perspective from the eyes of the Native Americans in particular. I hope that helps, in terms of healing, because there is this divide that we feel, and there's, it feels like unnecessary in today's world, because we have so many challenges in so many ways, you know, that coming together as Americans, either way, I think is valuable here. Does this Little Bighorn National Monument represent that, to the tilt, 100%?
Yeah, I think we're trying. I don't know if we 100% have gotten there right now, but like you said, I think it's important to understand this site, its impact on history, and sort of view it from all those places. How can we reconcile things that have happened to the past? How can we learn from history, is often sort of touted as the importance of preserving these historic sites, and how we can kind of come together in that reconciliation and healing to move forward in a productive way. And I think that's a unique opportunity for the National Park Service, since we are a federal organization, and we are required by, you know, law to consult with tribal nations, as this is part of their story as federal. So building those partnerships with the new visitor center, with this 150th celebration, has been really kind of impactful for me in my position. It's been a huge learning experience as the interpretation program manager, and spurring kind of ideas on how we can do that, and share that with the public as well.
Yeah, I was actually going to go there, because I noted you've worked on the East Coast, you've worked in the West, and in other places as well. What about this story, as you came to Hardin, Montana, or to this National Monument. What impressed you about it, or what didn't you know that kind of stands out?
Oh, man, I can tell you that before I got here, I had no idea how much the general public sort of worldwide knew about this battle. Mm. I think I kind of came to the site with everyone else's sort of foundational knowledge of, you know, I'd seen shows about it or had learned about it, you know, in school. But I didn't realize how much it sort of reverberated through everything. It's kind of interesting. I have a volunteer serving with us this summer who's from Italy. And when she was talking to her friends and family about coming over here to volunteer, they even knew about Little Bighorn Battlefield. And like I said, I have Irish folks who come over because there's a huge connection with the 7th Cavalry having members from Ireland. So it's really interesting to just see how much staying power this battlefield has had over 150 years and learning even more about that with tribal consultation and talking to the local communities around here has been really eye-opening for me about how impactful this two-day event in history really has been. So it's been a huge learning experience for me. I don't pretend to be an expert in the battle at all. I think I've been often told it's one of the most written about events in U.S. history. The bibliography is like 800 pages long. So I think you could be a lifelong sort of student of this battle and still not know everything about it. So that's been really exciting for me to try to learn about this, learn about those cultural connections from overseas to, you know, the community in Hardin with the Crow Nation and the Northern Cheyenne Nation. So it keeps me on my toes, which is really exciting.
And here's another one off the cuff, and it's very introspective as well. What do you think humanity learns from this? Maybe, and not that we're done learning from history in that regard, but what do you think is humanity's lesson about all of this?
You know, that's really kind of interesting, and I've been thinking a lot about that on the eve of just sort of this being the 250 years, the celebration for the United States, where with this event in this year, we're kind of inviting the public to stand where that history happened, asking, you know, what it still has us to teach. But in the end, sort of beyond that, this year, the nation is also learning that same lesson, you know, that growth comes from remembering honestly and from including every experience that shaped it. So to me, it's really kind of important to think about the Battle of Little Bighorn at the 150th, but in conjunction with America's 250th celebration on remembering that history, learning from it, and kind of growing from it. Like we talked about sort of earlier in this conversation, but that's what I think the public can learn from this event, especially because, as we touched upon earlier, that interpretation has changed through time as well. So going beyond that, who do we want to be as kind of an American public and how we interpret this site and how we learn from it?
Melinda McFaul.
What I think about.
Yeah, thank you for that. And again, I just I threw it on you. It's a little bit deep as well, but I think we're always pulling those questions out of history. What do we learn from that? Are we better now? Are we still going to make that same mistake? And so we get to ask those questions, and there's not always the, you know, 100% right on answer on it as well. Hey, so, but great stuff. Thank you, Melinda. Stand by. All right. We'll take a break and come on back. There's going to be some regalia going on there. You've got the Parade of Nations and tribal flags, and then the color guards. A lot of presentations. And just a whole weekend of events, and we'll talk more about that. Melinda McFarland is with us, Interpretation and Visitor Services Program Manager at the Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument. Back with more in a bit. It's right in our backyard, one of America's most historical moments here. And it was Custer's last stand for so many years. And then our perspectives began to change about that. Thanks to those folks who spoke out about it and those folks who listened about it as well. And now that battlefield was renamed in 1991 from then to now the, I miss it all the time, the Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument. They're celebrating their 150th commemoration this weekend. It begins actually Thursday. Melinda McFarland is with us here on Voices of Montana. She is the Interpretation and Visitor Services Program Manager. You can find out more. It's nps.gov, or just do a little search, Little Bighorn Battlefield. And you'll get right into it here. And Melinda, thanks for coming on. You guys have been making some changes there. I know the visitor center, I don't think it's done yet, but, you know, let's talk about those logistics because, reenactments are going to happen, but that's, going to be done not by the Park Service, but by, members of tribes that have gathered to do that, on some land nearby. We heard about that earlier this year. So let's get into let's kick it off, the 25th. What happens?
Yeah, so the most kind of important thing for folks interested in coming out for this three-day event is we will have speakers and events happening June 25th, 26th, and 27th. For those who have ever been out to the battlefield, we have a very small property, so we cannot accommodate all the vehicles that may want to show up. So we are closing the park to pedestrian and vehicle traffic to kind of open up space for those events. So there will be an off-site parking area less than 3 minutes from the site that folks will be directed to as they exit off of 90 to park at. And the Park Service will be providing a free shuttle service from that parking area to the site. And then the 25th is going to be probably the busiest day. So for folks who want to experience that, we welcome them out. For folks who want to visit days that are a little bit less crowded, please come out on the 26th and 27th. But the 25th is the big kickoff. So there will be an opening sort of ceremony, remarks. We're going to have a parade of tribal nations. So the park has 19 affiliated tribes to the site. They'll come parading down from this Indian Memorial, 7th Cavalry Memorial with flags, singing their flag songs, victory songs, along with the national anthem and a flyover. So really kind of kicking off the events, some welcome talks from tribal leaders and delegation. And then I think what a lot of folks get really excited about every year is there's an annual horse charge, and that's going to be even bigger this year as multiple tribes have come together. So that does occur off of park property. They sort of charge a fence line, but this year they will actually then come into the park and parade on the park road. So it will be a really kind of exciting celebration of the importance of the horse to not only this battle, but to tribal nations and sort of how that changed their traditional way of life with that horse. And then we'll get into speakers ranging from sort of focusing on women warriors, archaeology, historians talking about specific members of the 7th Cavalry. So there should be something for everyone. And we'll have a couple of education tents as well to just talk to folks about the site. We have a couple guest education booths as well. So hopefully a little bit of something for everyone is our goal.
What are the hours?
Yes, so the gates will open at 8 a.m. And they'll close at 6 p.m. Events will start around 9:30 and then go till about 5 o'clock. The shuttles will start earlier than 8 a.m. to help around 7 o'clock to get people into the site as well. So,
yeah, that makes a lot of sense, especially when you're dealing with a lot of people and a lot of horses as well, right?
Absolutely.
Are you guys accommodating or is it the Real Bird family that's accommodating all those horses?
The Real Bird family is accommodating all the horses.
Nice.
They've been very, very graceful and cooperative in providing areas for folks to board the horses and tribal nations to camp out. So, and they're the ones that do the reenactment. So folks are looking for that opportunity. We do not host it at the National Park Service site, but at 1 o'clock on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the Real Birds will be hosting that reenactment.
So 1 o'clock then for Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. That's really cool that goes on, right?
Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Sorry.
Oh, it's not Thursday. Okay, Friday, Saturday.
Not Thursday. No.
Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. All right. Talk about that. Talk about how important it is to have a reenactment. I mean, if I'm going to go and visit the battlefield, I want to see a reenactment, you know?
Yeah, I think it all comes down to really bringing history to life, right? People are interested and invested in things that they care about. And so a lot of visitors do like to see that reenactment, bringing that history to life, especially younger generations connecting that they can remember and kind of get excited about that, then we hope that that can translate into sort of further study as they get older. So I think just that excitement and connection is really where the reenactments come into play.
And on site there, how far off is that visitor center from being completed?
We are hoping that the building will be completed the fall of this year, hopefully being open for the winter season, and then the new exhibits will go in spring of next year is sort of the tentative timeline.
We got a question here, and I don't have time to take it right now, but it was kind of on my plate here as well. You guys are still digging in the battlefield. You guys are still studying this battlefield, right?
Absolutely. And that's kind of the cool thing about history in of itself is it's almost like detective work is new sources or new discoveries come to play of how you're putting those pieces together to learn about what happened. And so the big archaeology happened back in the 80s after a fire came through the monument. It actually changed battlefield archaeology. Little Bighorn sort of changed that practice, which is pretty awesome to think about. And so, again, as oral histories come to light, as new discoveries come to light, as just the practice of science changes and we're able to even go into the park's collection of archival material or archaeological material and do new studies on those with advances in technology, it's pretty exciting. And during the event on the 26th, we'll actually have a presentation by Douglas Scott and Melissa Connor about how archaeology has shaped the battlefield on that day, as they were the two primary archaeologists in the 80s that did a lot of that work.
Is there more information about a battle nearby, the Rosebud Battle, folded in here?
We don't have anything in our agenda about the Rosebud. They had their big 150th celebration on June 17th. They're definitely two connected battlefields, as a lot of the tribes that were involved in the Battle of Rosebud then moved and joined the large encampment on the Little Bighorn, and then fought the 7th Cavalry again 8 days later. So definitely connection points between the two.
Yeah. All this stuff is fascinating, and it gets highlighted this weekend, the 25th, the 26th, the 27th, and then Sunday the reenactment continues with a horse charge at 1 p.m. as well. We'll get back with more here. Melinda McFarland is the Interpretation and Visitor Services Program Manager at the Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument, the 150th anniversary commemoration this weekend. We got more upcoming here today on Voices.
Voices of Montana continues right after this. The fastest hour in Montana radio continues. Call 866-627-5483 and join Montana's statewide radio talk show, Voices of Montana with Tom Schultz.
Our 250th celebration ongoing right here and right now all across the country. But something more closer to home is commemorating 150 years. And it is interesting to note it was really America's military's only domestic loss, the Battle of Little Bighorn, Custer's Last Stand, as it was known up until 1991. 150 years ago, 263 soldiers approximately lost their lives fighting there. And there was a lot. As you go back and look at this, Custer himself was criticized, highly criticized. He had scouts from the Crow tribe and Arikara, and they warned him that there was a village that was organizing because it was summer hunting time. And this village, it's not your what Custer might have seen, a gathering of 150, 200, or up to 300. No, it was much larger. It stretched for miles because these tribes were cooperating in this hunt, but also against a common enemy as well. Welcome back here to Voices of Montana. Yeah, we are talking about this commemoration this weekend here, June 25th, 26th, and 27th. Belinda McFarland is with us, the Interpretation and Visitor Centers Visitor Services Program Manager at the battlefield, NPS.gov, for more information. Melinda, I appreciate your time here. I want to go to the phones here because Damien is listening out there in Glendive area, eastern Montana. Hello to friends up there, too, KDZN 96.5 FM. And and has a question I think that comes up frequently. Good morning, Damien. You're on the air with Melinda McFarland from the National Park Service.
Good morning. The question is kind of a digger. My wife and I both are. Steve's part of Lakota tribe, and me just being an old cowboy around here, I got my engine clinches. But we take part of the reenactment. We come on up, and we see it every year, and it gets better and better every year. And I also stay in touch with my buddy Scott Walter. We were up looking around a few years ago trying to come up with some ideas as to where all the Springfield firearms went and Custer's payroll, and we got some permission through the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and we got to go in for quite a while. About the time that we started seeing some sign and really started to get interesting, they shut us all down.
Mm.
So I guess my question to the American people is, was something being done or enacting the Congress to find where these payrolls went? Because it's more than just a treasure that belonged to you and me and the natives. It's a treasure that belongs to everybody, and I believe, and my wife included, it belongs in museums. All these firearms, all these payrolls, what happened to the paddle wheel, the Far West. I mean, there's some things that are real interesting into our history that no one is bringing out. My question to all the Americans out there is, why can't we make the Congress bring back these treasures that do belong to everybody?
All right, Damien.
They're being hoarded off by a tribe of Indians. They raided the Two Moons tomb, and that's a big part of that war, too. So there's quite a few things that we're going to go check around this year up there and ask a few questions and hopefully make another friend or two on the way. But if anybody out there has any information, I'd sure like to hear it.
Damien, I appreciate that question, too. We're kind of breaking up a little bit there, and I think we got the gist of it here. He's a digger, goes out and finds these artifacts, so to speak, Melinda. And I think that question comes up with a lot of people. Who owns these artifacts? Is it the government? Is it the person who finds them? Is it the land that it's on? And then how do you process those from there? Do you guys encounter that? You guys are still digging there, you guys, whoever that is. So obviously that's a concern about what's the ownership of some of these artifacts, huh?
Oh yeah. And that gets into a complicated question.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Thanks, Damien. Yeah.
Sort of, landowners and all of that. I can speak from the National Park Service side. So we are a federal agency, so anything within our collection, which is currently at the Western Archaeological Conservation Center in Tucson, as they have the building and the staff that can properly care for these items, do belong to sort of all of the American people. We did repatriate a lot of cultural items to affiliated tribes, because there's a law that was passed in 1990 called the Native American Grave Repatriation and Protection Act. So we're federally mandated to discuss certain ceremonial items that were found in graves, that sort of stuff, and repatriate those to tribes. With the archaeological collection and those other sort of artifacts, especially the Libby Custer collection, those are open to research, so if folks wanted to come in and research those, they would need to contact that Western Archaeological Conservation Center in Tucson. We do put a lot of the photographs up available, the historic photographs for the public to view and things like that. And as we open up the new visitor center, although we won't have a lot of those collections in the new building, I am trying to figure out a way to have that connection with the public, offering up alternatives, highlighting more of them on the website so folks can learn about them. And although not see them in person, hopefully at least see them digitally and explore our collections a little bit more.
Yeah, great answer. And Damien, good question too. Is it an issue, Melinda?
The artifacts? Or?
Well, yeah, does it rise enough where it's creating conflict, or are the methods that we have for resolving those kinds of conflicts with some of these artifacts, are they in place and are they working? Are you finding more artifacts, and does this issue arise?
We aren't really finding too much more at this point in time. We're not currently doing any sort of archaeological surveys or anything at this moment. We didn't find anything with the new building of the visitor center. Most of sort of the artifacts left on the battlefields are bullet casings and things like that. There are always sort of folks who contact me saying that they have certain objects that may have belonged to so-and-so, and that goes through a whole authentication process. I think, especially with this battlefield and artifacts, there's a lot of history that goes into it. So any objects that were removed off the battlefield by tribal citizens, there's a complicated history of not wanting to be associated with those objects or a fear of repercussion. So there are still things that kind of come out, but we have to understand sort of the fear associated back in the late 1800s or early 1900s. If you were a tribal member and you had sort of a weapon or a cavalry associated item with the fear of repercussion. So a lot of those objects have been kind of lost or just haven't come forward. It's also a battlefield in eastern Montana that's seen many winters and all of that. So I'm sure some artifacts have just been lost to time and weather. So there's not a huge amount of objects to begin with, which is kind of why we're not bringing a lot of them back into the new visitor center. We're trying to highlight sort of the aftermath story, what led up to the battle. And a lot of times the artifacts that we have can only be on display for so many years. And then when we take them off, we don't have a plethora of objects in the collection to replace that same sort of object. So our first and foremost mission is preservation of those objects so they can be studied, they can be viewed for many, many years. The last thing we want to do is put them on display and accidentally damage the item and then that be lost.
Yeah. And you must have kind of at least, puffed up a little bit when Damien said it keeps getting better, right? He goes there every year and it just keeps getting better. What is the usual experience there? Of course, it's a huge celebration this weekend, but what is kind of like the everyday experience there at the Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument?
Yeah, I would say the everyday sort of experience, not on an anniversary or our folks come in and we have the visitor center in normal years. Right now we have a little temporary contact station that folks can come in and get oriented to the site. There's waysides all along the tour road that walk folks through what happened to the battle. National Park Service staff offer during the summertime anywhere from 4 to 5 programs throughout the day, kind of highlighting just different stories related to the battle, kind of prompting visitors to think a little bit differently about it. We also have a concessionaire of Solica Tours that offers hour-long programs that folks can pay to get on a bus and travel through the site and get that narration through the battlefield, which if you're have that deep interest in history, can be really kind of impactful. That's led by the Crow Tourism Board, and it's a really powerful thing to connect that story to the physical landscape, which was something that really kind of changed my perspective on it, having read about the site before I came out to work here and then actually being on the landscape. I think is really powerful to see the hills and the grass and how that shaped the battlefield. I talk about this a lot with visitors on how land just kind of holds that history and you just get that sense of feeling. And I talk to visitors about that there's definitely a presence. There's definitely kind of this gravity when you're at that site. So I encourage folks, you know, if they haven't been out, just being on the physical landscape is powerful enough, whether you spend 20 minutes looking out at it or if you have a full day and really kind of want to dig into all those programs and all the interpretive opportunities.
We're back here with Melinda McFarland, Interpretation and Visitor Services Program Manager at the Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument. Big celebration this weekend. Again, you're reminding folks it's Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Activities will continue both on-site and off-site. There'll be some Native tribes gathering as well. The horse charge at 1 o'clock Friday and Saturday and Sunday. What to bring? No food. So there's still some logistics to keep in mind. Give us one more shot of that, would you?
Yeah, so just remind folks that it's June out here in Montana. It can be pretty hot, so make sure that you bring weather sort of appropriate gear. We will have water filling stations throughout the site, but we are encouraging folks to bring their own water bottles to fill up. Like it was mentioned, we don't have any food vendors, so we're encouraging folks to bring food and snacks, kind of pack your picnic lunch if you plan to attend the full day, but we'll have a stage set up. There will be seating, so folks don't really need to worry about bringing their own chairs. We should have those available, but we just want to make sure that everyone stays safe out there. So plan for hot weather, bring snacks and water bottles.
Isn't it amazing that there's friends and enemies from many, many years ago? I mean, the Northern Cheyenne and Lakota were allies, but the Crow, not so. But the you know, the real birds are members of the Crow family. There were Crow Scouts. Isn't it amazing that after 150 years, you know, we still have these feelings, but we have opportunities like this to work on getting past them?
Yeah, I think this event kind of has brought folks together, and that's pretty exciting to see. And we're hoping that throughout the 3 days, we can listen to all the different perspectives and hear kind of about that and a coming together on an agenda. So it's pretty exciting in that regard.
Can you really handle 10,000 folk? I mean, one of my final questions here is, what's going to be your takeaway from this? But it came out with, wow, 10,000 people. How do you handle that? That would be my takeaway.
Yeah, I mean, we're pretty lucky. We've brought in some extra folks, an incident command team that's helping us at the park organize and manage the event. Again, safety sort of our priority. So there will be ambulances on site, first aid, EMTs, all of that kind of stuff. So we should be able to manage it in a safe way. We're pretty confident in that. But I think the takeaway that I have is, if we do end up having 10,000 people a day, it really reaffirms to me that people are invested in this story and learning about history. And I think that's pretty amazing to show that there's that interest in an event that happened 150 years ago.
Yeah, and you're going to meet just a ton of folk too, aren't you?
Oh, I'm very excited about it. I'm looking at this weekend as a huge learning opportunity for me, listening to the speakers, meeting everyone from the public and the tribes, and you'll see me kind of just wandering around, making sure that my staff's taken care of, and just seeing it as a learning opportunity.
Taking it all in. Yeah, Melinda McFarland again. Thank you for coming on. I appreciate that. Thanks for doing this, and give everybody a pat on the back for us, all right? And good luck this weekend.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us for the podcast. And join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.